Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Every Friday at 6 o'clock, we bring someone on to talk about this and that, some serious things, some less serious things, but someone who has opinions and has thoughts and has a personality, has all those kinds of things that are great for radio. And this is someone we have been trying to get on the show for a long time, but, you know, busy people, busy schedules, it's tough sometimes. But we have got Phil Perkins from CHCHTV, anchor, co-anchor, guest, not guest, but what do you call yourself, Phil? What is your proper title on CHCH? Anchor of the evening news, right? Co-anchor?
I'm a videographer by day, co-host of the evening news by night, you know, often sometimes producer, you know, all those things.
All those things. A very, very long resume. Your business card folds out. That's how big it is. Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate you jumping in.
Oh, 100%. I love it. I started in radio as an intern, and I'm all about the visual medium, or the theater of the mind.
Visual will work too. Like I was going to say, speaking of visual, the Canadian Open Golf Tournament is on this week. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, did you see the seats that they have set up for the 18th green? I think it's at the 18th green there, the sky seats. Have you seen these?
Yep. Yes, to bet. I saw some ads for Scorebet or whoever, that you can bet from up there. And are you supposed to have a better vantage point and make a more educated bet by seeing the trajectory of the ball?
Anyone who hasn't seen this, they've got a crane set up, which is hooked up to this. It's like a round table that has roller coaster type seats. So you're harnessed in and they raise you up to like 100 or 150 feet off the ground. So you can be above the course. But I'm with you. I'm not entirely sure. It's cool. I'm not entirely sure if you see golf better from that vantage point. Like, do you think the birds understand the game better than we do? Or I'm not sure.
I have no clue. But I remember in Summerlicious in Toronto, they had a thing where you paid an exorbitant amount of money, which I'm sure you do here, and you eat when you're up that high.
Yes.
Hoisted on a crane. So, like, would you rather watch golf from up there or would you rather eat from up there? I don't know what's more treacherous for the people down below. And just, is this an open bar up there? Like what's allowed? Like it can't be that much fun if you're, you know, just watching golf up there sober.
I don't know if it's sober or not, but there is some service. I'm not sure, but I'll tell you the two issues. So I was watching this and I got a media invite to go. I didn't do it. I too busy. And I thought, I think I would like to try that, but I'm not entirely sure. But the two comments everybody on social media has had is one, that looks terrifying. And two, what do you do if you have to go to the bathroom? And you're sort of, now I don't think you're up there for hours and hours, but I say that one, I'm looking at this going, that is a new take on how to serve up golf to people, to be way above the green. I'm not sure.
I was just thinking now, it would actually be a lot of fun to watch like a Ticats game from up there. There's a lot of space in the end zones. You can go, you can actually like break down plays. You can call it. I think that'd be a lot of fun. I always felt that sitting at field level kind of sucks for games like football and soccer or football, whichever side of the Atlantic you're on. But if you're up high like that, that'd actually be a lot of fun. I think that'd be great.
It's kind of like being in the press box, I suppose, although, you know, exactly the same, but completely different.
Your feet are banging. Yeah.
The one thing about it that I realized, though, is I would not want to be sitting up there if I was the one golfing. Like I wouldn't want to put someone I love up there if I was hitting, because there is a very, very high likelihood that I would drill you, because I would overshoot the green, absolutely guaranteed, and then plunk someone who's sitting up there.
Yeah, see me, I'd be more afraid of anyone who was sitting to the immediate right or left of me, because I'm just so bad at golf, so bad. And, you know, luckily I think all my family, well, on my mom's side, everyone's pretty good. But when I was meeting my in-laws for the first time, I actually took my future father-in-law's spot. They're going golfing. I'm like, oh no, these people have been sitting like by the golf course their whole life. They're going to see that I didn't pick up a golf club until grade 11. And they're talking about how expensive their clubs were, and they shanked everything. And it was awful. I'm like, thank goodness they're this bad at golf, then we're going to be good. I'm not good at golf.
There's the helpless feeling when the people around you know how to play and you don't. Years ago for a media event, I ended up playing around with Mackenzie Hughes, who for people that always from Dundas, he's on the PGA Tour and he's a lovely guy. He was very friendly about it, but you know, he gets up on the tee and drives it 320 yards down the middle And then four shots later, after exploring most of the wooded area, I've caught up with him. And you just know that he's thinking, why did I agree to come today? Why am I doing this? This is, But let me ask you, okay, so we got so many other things to get to, but you've heard about this LIV Golf, this thing, this new tour that's going on. Mm-hmm. Where a bunch of guys played on the PGA Tour have now taken unbelievably huge amounts of money, it seems, to go play in this rogue spin-off tour. If Phil Perkins was offered exorbitant dollars to go and work at a TV station where the people behind it were questionable or had questionable stuff in their background, or, you know, you're not really sure what you're getting in with, do you say, absolutely, it's exorbitant money, I've got to do this? Or do you say, I'm not sure I'm willing to risk my reputation, my future, my everything else to do this? What do you do when that happens?
Well, if we're going with the analogy of a news organization, that news organization has been, you know, connected to the killing of a journalist and other things, that would be something I would think about. I had a friend, obviously not going to name names, but they had an interview at a news company, and they asked in an interview, like, yo, how do you feel about guns? How do you feel about, you know, LGBTQ rights? And I was like, whoa, like, this is something that you ask in a job interview. And depending if you're for or against, or in this case against, like, you would get or not get a job. And I'd probably have to say no, because when I got into this business, my teacher, Jim Van Horn, TSN fame, said you don't get into this to be famous or to get rich. And I feel like my family gets bit by karma pretty hard. So I feel like if I were to sign a contract like that, I feel like it would come back and haunt me in some shape or form. Not wishing ill will to Phil Mickelson or, you know, DJ or anyone like that. But I'd have to say no.
That would be tough. It would be tough. I mean, the money they're talking about, where, you know, Phil Mickelson, apparently it's $200 million. Boy, you know, that would be a test of your standards to say, no, I don't think so.
Sports is weird like that. Sports is weird. Like the same people behind LIV or just bought Newcastle, and, you know, their fans are rabid, and they're long suffering fans. They want to get the Champions League, and here they are. They have these literally endless pockets, and they're thrilled. And so, like, you're cheering on a questionable owner, but sports makes people forget these things. And it's just, it's weird.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Phil, last week was the election. We all know that. Everyone is probably fatigued with all things politics after a federal election and then a provincial election. Of course, we have the municipal one coming up, but we won't get to that just yet. The big story, well, there's a number of big stories, but one of the big stories from this election that everyone has been talking about is the abysmal voter turnout, very, very low this time. And it's led a lot of people to have a lot of thoughts on what should happen with this. One of the ideas that gets bandied around every time there's an election where the numbers are low is mandatory voting, like they have in Australia. You get fined or you get some sort of penalty if you don't cast a ballot. What do you think about mandatory voting?
Well, then, what would the fine be? Because I feel I just feel like if it was a fine, if they followed the Australian model, if there is a fine, that, you know, I feel like, you know, certain marginalized communities, you're going to fine them, or there are going to be exceptions to this. I feel like that could be somewhat of a PR nightmare with that. I feel like, you know, I've seen on Twitter a bunch, you know, especially after, you know, leading with the abysmal turnout. Basically, people tweeting out there is like, "Hey, you can't complain now. If you didn't vote, you can't complain." I don't know how you govern that. If someone does complain about, "Oh, the healthcare sucks. Oh, you know, that highway is the worst. Oh, protect the greenbelt." Well, did you vote? No. Well, then shut up. But I don't know if that's something that could be policed. I don't know. I guess I wouldn't say a fine, but maybe. Oh gosh. I don't know.
The problem I have with the idea, and it's a very popular thing to say, you must vote. We need more participation, so you must vote. The problem I have with this, Phil, is if only 40% of people paid any attention to the election at all, if only 40% of the people bothered to learn who their candidate was or what the issues were or whatever else, those are the 40% that I want voting. I don't want the other 60% voting. If you've done nothing to educate yourself, why do I want to say you must then cast a ballot?
Right. No, it makes sense. Then just be like, well, I do like orange. Then I could, orange is cool. I like the ocean blue. Yeah, blue. You know what? That makes a lot of sense. You want the people who are engaged and know what the issues are at hand, things that they care about. Yeah, that makes sense. I am all for that. I was also, I don't know why I was thinking this, like maybe make Elections Ontario have an Instagram account and then you go on their stories and you could do one of those like Instagram story polls and there you voted. There you go. They could like almost like trick you. You just voted, by the way.
I don't know. Well, I mean, look, part of this is I think that probably a lot of our schools could do a better job at, because it's not just about when you're voting now. Like if you're 30 years old and all the way growing up, you never had anything that got you engaged in the process. Well, why are you suddenly, maybe because you're a taxpayer or maybe because you're trying to buy a house or something. But, you know, we've got to do, I think, a better job, not forcing people to vote, but making it so that they feel they want to be part of this. And I know it's easy to be cynical and politics makes people cynical and all the rest, but you know, if this was part of our, you know, if you learned this in civics, if schools did a better job so you saw the value of this and you became interested in this, we wouldn't have to be threatening people with fines if they didn't vote.
Yeah, I felt like when civics came about, so I graduated, well, that's high school, I graduated high school in 04, and civics was just kind of like a gimme class. Like, I don't think we really understood what we were doing. To be honest, maybe there's a better way to teach such things. Obviously, you know, there are new ways to teach kids and more, you know, broad based and how you can understand the importance of politics and how it could affect them. We never really got that. We just kind of had to understand how each political system worked. But yeah, if there's a way to kind of teach them young, same way how kids have grown up now and, you know, they understand the importance of preserving this planet and, you know, slowing down the heating of this small blue planet, maybe they can do the same with understanding just how important a vote is and how it could affect people for sure.
Well, and we've just started. I mean, it's in the last couple of years that the government, the provincial government announced that it's going to be bringing back financial literacy as part of the education program where, you know, like one of the most important things that you need to know when you get off into your life is so you don't run into financial problems is how to handle money. And we've ignored it for the longest time. We've essentially ignored it. Well, is it any surprise that people don't know how to handle money? And if you bring that back and if this actually works, why could the same thing not exist for politics and for, you know, more than, and here's the thing, Phil, more than just saying, you know, orange man in the States bad, you know, whatever, like more than just that kind of stuff, like really explain why it matters and why you should be engaged and how you can be engaged and all the, like, make it interesting.
Yeah. And make it something that they can relate to in their everyday life, whether it's, hey, do you enjoy your extracurricular activities? Well, the reason why teachers can do this is blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, hey, I remember like, gosh, I thought I broke my knee a couple years ago. And well, this is on the federal level, but you know, I got like a couple x-rays and I was just thinking, man, you know, if I lived in a different country, yada, yada, I'd have to pay like what, $500 a scan. And not saying that we're ever going to get to that point, though. Some people might feel that, you know, privatization of hospitals could be on the horizon now with the government in place, but you know, stuff like that, stuff, things that people can relate to on a daily basis that, you know, these type of decisions do affect your everyday life. And one thing for me, when Trudeau was voted in and now Doug Ford, I don't know why I'm using a first name basis here. Like, I don't know him. He doesn't know me. You know, it was the $10 day daycare, even though my kid's going to age out by that point. But, you know, these cuts from 25% to 50% is huge. It's gigantic. And again, it's not a provincial thing, but those type of things really do affect people on a regular basis. And if they can somehow fine tune that and cater it to teens and to understand, like, you know, these things matter. Hey, when you turn to the voting age, make it count, I think, yeah, potentially, if they find an engaging way to do it, I feel that it could, you know, pay off in a big way, kind of like what they're doing with finances, because that's also gigantic.
You know, and there's, I mean, there's other things that other people have suggested as a way other than just, you know, forced voting. I mean, certainly digital voting is something that's been talked about a lot, that whether or not that would, and again, you know, I know that that's modern and I know that's convenient and everything else. I got to say, I still have some issues with that idea for the same reason, is if you make it too easy, if you make it too nonchalant, then you, again, you're getting the people who have paid no attention to participate. And on the one hand, that's good, I suppose. On the other hand, if you're not even caring enough to know who's running in your riding,
right?
And I'm paying taxes and I'm doing, I want people who are somewhat, at least somewhat engaged. And if you make it too easy, then, you know, then it becomes like a social thing. Hey, you know, Bob, did you vote? Oh, here, go on and do it. And like, I don't... To me, it's so important that there should be some effort put into it. Some.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think another thing is, I just don't think people are engaged in this election. Just if you watched our election coverage, it was, people weren't engaged because the candidates weren't engaging. And
Agreed.
It's kind of like a TV show. Like I love sports. Like, you know, it's a, you know, if you look at my resume, I doubt anyone has ever done that. Like, I went to the College of Sports Media. I have like a kinesiology degree. I love sports. And someone asked, like, you know, would you ever, you know, trade sports for covering politics? I'm like, honestly, politics is sports. It's like the way they talk to you, they kind of don't answer your questions. It's entertainment in a way, on the TV side, at least. When it came to this election, if this was like a TV show or, you know, the NBA finals, you know, you got your Draymond Greens, you got your villains, if you want to call them that, you know, you got the young upstart Celtics. But then when it comes to these candidates, and we talked about it on our show, there was really no one that caught your attention, that kind of got your spirit going. So maybe that could be it, especially after people were so tired from the pandemic. And yeah, it was just,
they were dry. They did not help the cause here at all. And I don't know how you, make that a rule that says you have to have an interesting candidate. I mean, you know, they've paid for it. I mean, we got to go, but they've paid for having dull candidates. Honestly, the Liberals got obliterated again, and the NDP is where they were, and, you know, nothing ever changed.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We are joined this Friday evening by Phil Perkins of CHCH. Been trying to get him for a long time, and he is finally here. And part of the reason why it's so hard to get Phil is because he is so busy all the time, which is a perfect segue, or, well, I don't want to describe my own segues as perfect, but it's an appropriate segue to the idea, Phil, that we now in this province, we have been told that we are going to have this new right to disconnect from work policy. This is going to be the thing now, that you are going to have the absolute right to step away from work, and they can't do anything to make you want to work more or log in or whatever. Do you think this is going to work, or do you think this is window dressing to make it sound like people can get on with their lives, but really it's almost impossible for something like this to happen?
At least in our industry, like every time we hear stories about a 4-day work week or something like this, we're like, yeah, okay, 4-day work week in our business, like that's never going to happen. News doesn't sleep, and people get sick, especially with COVID, and, you know, they always need backfill. And it's just, I mean, if you want to commit to it, I can see that happening in some industries, but, you know, in ours, what I try to do myself is I just try to unplug on my own, like on weekends. Like I only have the Saturday, Sunday. That's the one benefit, at least in this biz. I'm not all over the place. It's still Monday to Friday. But on Saturdays, I try to disconnect from Twitter. If I do, I have another account that's like my sports fan vlog. So that's all it is. And I try not to watch the news, and try to take my phone away and just not look and disconnect in that sense, because unfortunately in this biz, it's a lot of phone, a lot of screens. And so I try to disconnect in that sense. But if there's a rule that they can't call me in for a sixth day, I don't know. I feel like would I still take it? It depends, because I still got bills to pay. I have a baby. And so I think it might be a bit of window dressing. I think it all depends on each industry. My wife works in in a law firm. There's no way they're going to tell these high priced lawyers, you know, just, yeah, you're fine. If we need something right away, we'll wait till Monday. Like, I don't see that.
Well, in 2022, like, this is the thing. I look at this and I think, like, what businesses could this be for? Well, okay. So if you work, let's say, in retail, and I'm not dismissing people who work in retail, they're very important. But if you work in retail, you could theoretically say, I only am going to work the certain number of days. But even then, what happens, as you say, if three people who are supposed to work get sick and the boss calls you? And like, I don't even know how this is supposed to work, because they say, well, you shouldn't have to check your email. But surely almost anybody in any line of work, if your email goes off, you're going to check. And then if it's your boss who's reached out to you, are they in trouble for reaching out to you because it's an emergency?
And what's going to happen to that boss?
That's what I mean.
Suspended without pay or something like that?
That's what I mean. Like, how do you make something like this work in a world when we do work 24 hours a day? Not technically, we're not all work, but we're all seemingly on all the time. I don't know. And maybe that's just us. Maybe that's you and me talking, and people listening are in a different world that we don't associate with, so that they're saying, no, I can completely disconnect easily. I can't.
Well, I guess if we want to adopt like a European model, which I think where all this is kind of coming from, you know, to live a more relaxed life and, you know, work to live instead of live to work, then we got to understand that. All right. Well, unless we organize things like construction, because if you can't call a construction worker in to, you know, to meet a deadline to work that extra day, because you got to follow the rules and you got to organize shifts a certain way, but you got to just expect that things will happen slower. And just not as great. And you're not going to get what you want when you want it, because, you know, certain people can't be reached at this time. And
are people going to accept that? I don't think people will accept that.
No, not here. Like, when we go on vacation in Europe, people are like, why are you so high strung? Like, why do we go to Europe? Because you go to, you know, I'm not saying I go there frequently. I'm talking like I go to the Mediterranean all the time just to unwind. But, you know, but that's why. I remember for my honeymoon, I did go to Italy, and my friend who's Turkish and very well traveled, I met him in university. He's like, wow, I can see the stress has just melted off your face. And, you know, maybe because I absorbed that, you know, that mentality, because it's so ingrained in us. But that's why North America is doing what it does economically. And, you know, Italy, at least the southern part of Italy, is doing what it's doing. And we would have to accept, yeah, there's going to be some drawbacks if not everyone can work and all the time. And
so you just hit the point exactly, though, that I think, and that is, we all want to say, I want to be able to disconnect from my work, but assuming that your work has anything to do with anybody else. So if you're in medicine, or as I say, in retail, as long as your work touches someone else, they don't want to not be able to get that service when they need to get that service. So we want to be able to step away, but nobody else wants you to be able to step away. And I don't think there's going to be a lot of happiness the first time that they say, I'm sorry, we have no nurses in the ER today. You're going to have to go home.
Well, look what's happening at Pearson Airport.
And exactly. Precisely.
The insanity that's happening. It's like, well, there's only two people working customs. Well, imagine, like, if there's only two or one, is like, well, why can't you call anyone? Well, I can't. They all booked it off. What am I supposed to do? I can't. They literally can't look at their phones. And so, yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether it'd be there'd be kind of like, you know, during wave one, there'll be the essential list where they're the essential services. You know, you got to work. Sorry, you chose this lot. This is what's happening now. So you're a TTC driver. Yeah. They're not automated yet. You got to go.
Let me throw one other idea at you that is going to become a problem, I think, with this whole concept. And that is, so Phil Perkins says, you know what, I'm entitled to be on the disconnect list, but I'm, you know, I'm someone who's really ambitious and I want to get ahead and I want to eventually be the anchor on the TV news. And so, you know what, you can call me. I'm relinquishing my restrictions against the boss. I'm on the list that says, feel free to call me because I want to get ahead. Well, now the people who aren't on that list are either going to feel obligated to go on that list or be left behind, or they're going to say, no, Phil Perkins can't be on that special list because it's going to give him an advantage.
Right. No, absolutely. And heck, like, I don't know what you were like when you got into this biz, but when I was like, do you want a job? Yeah. It starts at 1 a.m. No one wants to do it. Yeah, I'll take it. And then I, you know, I did it. And I did it for 2 years. And, you know, if you have people who are crazy like me or who wanted to do that, or, you know, waiting tables, doing double shifts and all that craziness until 4 a.m. and then coming back at 10, you're going to get those people. Because at the end of the day, like, we haven't touched it on it, but like, everything's expensive. Can you really afford to take, you know, an extra day off or not work an extra shift for a couple extra $100, depending on what you do? Would you really want to, you know, forego that to enjoy life? I don't know. It depends on what your economic situation is, I guess.
I think it's a nice idea. I think it's a lovely wording and everything else. I think it's entirely going to be almost impossible to enforce, and wait till the first boss does get fined or whatever else. I don't even know what the penalty is. For calling someone and saying, I want you to work. And that person says, I was offended that you called me. I'm with you. You either grind away and you work hard and you get it, or you choose not to as much, then you really want to have that disconnect. But I think you're going to end up with where we are now, which is two different groups, one who is very ambitious and one who wants a job and wants to pay the bills, but wants to step away. And I hate to say it, I don't see how that's going to change where we are now, where one moves ahead faster and one doesn't.
Right. Absolutely. And then, you know, the super duper wealthy people who don't really follow any schedule, they'll just be like, what just happened? What just changed? Yeah. Like, it doesn't matter.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Phil, we saw news come out of British Columbia last week, I think roughly last week, that said that maybe it's before then, but they are going to decriminalize some amounts of hard drugs. In essence, in BC, for small amounts, all drugs will be decriminalized, not just cannabis like it is across the country. And there are very, very different takes on this and points of view on this idea. And I don't know that there's a right or a wrong answer on this one, but where do you stand on the idea? Because the thought behind this is, if we decriminalize it, it maybe makes people less likely to be as scared of going for help for addiction or for overdoses or whatever. The flip side is, if we decriminalize it, we in some ways almost kind of endorse it or say it's not that bad. Where do you stand on this?
Well, my brother lives in Vancouver, and like, he's an animator there, and his studio, one of his studios he worked at, was in Gastown, which is like a hop, skip, and a jump from East Hastings, which, if you've ever walked through that, is wild. It is like, you know, the zombie apocalypse type thing. And it's my best description of it. I've never seen someone, you know, this is obviously more than the amount that they're saying is decriminalized. But, you know, you see people shooting up in broad daylight. And, you know, he was taught as an animator, you know, he has a degree in college animation at Humber, you know, how to give naloxone to someone who's overdosing in front of the studio. And a lot of these, you know, people, from what I understand, they're overdosing on drugs that, and we've learned in the pandemic, they're laced with some bad stuff. You know, one grain of carfentanil can kill you. It's not just the decriminalization of it. It's if there was a way that, kind of like with cannabis, if they can legalize small amounts, that, you know, if you are an addict and you want to get help, but it's just to steer you away from getting something from the street, and you can get something from the government that's 100% what you want it to be and not laced with something else, and we could prevent the deaths, because the amount of overdoses they're getting out there, specifically in Vancouver, like, my brother tells me the stats all the time. And he was even telling me during the pandemic as well, he's like, yeah, they're talking about COVID deaths, but look at these, you know, these opioid overdoses. And it was wild out there. If there's a way that, you know, people who have problems can get their hands on something that is like 100% good, if you want to call it good, from the government, the same way the cannabis is, you don't have to worry about it being laced with something. Maybe that's a better route in terms of preventing overdose deaths. But when it comes to, you know, promoting or deterring people from doing it,
It's so hard. And let me tell you why. I mean, I agree with you on the idea that if you could have something that would be safer, right, that would be better. Mm-hmm. There was a piece in The Conversation on theconversation.com. People can go find it online. It's an excellent, it's got a lot of interesting stuff on it. And they were talking about what has happened with cannabis. Now, cannabis is obviously not what we're talking about exactly here, but since there's now been legalized cannabis sales in the country, cannabis, according to this story, Canadians have increased the amount they spend per month on legal cannabis by 428% in 3 years. And that is my concern here, is the idea that when a government says, we're going to sell this to you, there is an implicit sense that this is, it's safe and it's okay. Right. And if you now take this from cannabis, and again, I'm not being reefer madness here, but if you take this from cannabis and you say, we're now going to sell you cocaine, we're going to sell you heroin, there is a sense, or at least, I don't know what the right word is, that somehow we're telling you it's okay to use this stuff. It's safe.
Right.
And it's not. Right. That's the problem. No, it's not.
Yeah. The downward spiral from, you know, taking an edible from your, you know, one of the cannabis stores, the multiple ones on Hess, you know, it's not going to end up in the same way, as we've now learned through science, that it's not going to, the downward spiral, if there is one, that's not the same as if you had a night out with some cocaine and potentially some heroin as well, all bought from the government, right? Hypothetically speaking. But I guess the message that they are sending, like, this is good, it's from us, it's good, you'll be fine. I think that in that case, I don't know if it's the message part, but I guess for more so the small amounts of, you're not going to be getting arrested with it, I guess that's a situation that it comes to the jails and how expensive it is to just overcrowd, and the health situation of filling jails up with people who have just a little bit of those illicit drugs on them.
Yep.
There's that sense, the message it sends out that, hey, you can have a little bit of cocaine on you, you're not going to go to jail, and then you're not going to get busted. Will it lead to, I don't know, 17 or 18 year olds or whoever, 20 year olds carrying whatever amount that is and going for it?
Who knows? And the other side, right, Phil, is that I look at this and I think, okay, not to be Mr. Prude here, but if you suddenly say it's allowed that you can have it, do you talked about in Vancouver where there are pockets, where there's areas where this is really bad. Well, does it come out even more in the open, where now downtowns are dealing with, you know, all this stuff everywhere, because now the cops aren't going to stop you at all, because, you know, if you have 2.5 grams, I mean, I don't even know how much it is, but if you have 2.5 grams versus 2.8 grams, like, are they going to stop you if you have 4 grams? It just, to me, there's so many issues, and I can see both sides. That's the problem. Yeah. I can see both sides of this one.
Mm-hmm. And I don't really know how the chemistry works. Like, if you have, let's get to like 2 grams of cocaine, someone listening to this probably like, that's a lot. Like, I don't know. Like, if,
who knows?
If you have just that on you and you take it, are you really going to be that out of control? Like, I don't like, how does it work? Like, is it, you know, at a time? So I got 2.5 here, boom. And then I'm going to go to the other side of town, do another two. And then the other side, I do another two, like, and I'm going to buy from different places. It seems like a lot of work. Would it make the streets go crazy? I don't know. I don't understand. I don't know the chemistry of someone on a little bit of heroin. Like, what would that do to their, if they were to do, like, you know, the current levels that people are doing in, you know, in East Hastings.
I don't know. Do we want this stuff out in the open on James Street North as an example? And again, I don't know if it would be, but I don't know. There's always just this sense that I have that when the government says that it's okay, that you're sending a message, and it's the same with booze. I mean, it's not the same, but it's the same. You know what I mean? It's like when you have liquor stores that are government run, you're saying booze is safe. And if you treat it properly, it can be not that bad for you. I don't know if it's ever good for you, but it can be not that bad for you. But does everybody? No. Right. No.
Yeah, you're always going to have someone. There's always that person who takes it too far. No, 100%. And Yeah, I don't know.
Like, I don't know what to do with it.
Are they saying it's okay? You could put as many labels as you want on a government issued. I'm not saying, well, they, obviously, I'm saying government issued like illicit drugs. We're not saying that they're now supplying it, but they're not.
No.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
You know, I didn't know this, Phil, until I looked online. I was, you know, doing some usual Facebook, Instagram, whatever, snooping around just to, you know something about you. Tell me, what was the deal with this, the photo that I found of you helping Dick Vitale fix his phone?
Oh, man. Okay. So, yeah. So when I got to CH, like the CH was literally my first job ever. I interned at TSN Radio 1050 in Toronto for a year. So I got into the biz and I didn't know anything. Like I was working and I just wanted to know more. And as I mentioned in the previous hour, I went to the College of Sports Media. You know, I have a passion for sports and I just wanted to work at ESPN one day, work somewhere, work at CBS Sports. And my goal growing up was always to be in the States and to kind of live that. And I met some people who were working down there and they told me about the National Sports Writers and Sports Broadcaster Association award show and banquet in Salisbury, North Carolina. And I thought, oh, that's where I'll learn how to network and how the business works and all that stuff. And look, Bob Costas is going to be there and Dick Vitale and Dan Patrick. And these are all guys I really looked up to. And I went there every June, I think, or whenever the College World Series is, maybe every May or June. And Dick Vitale was being inducted into the Sportscaster Hall of Fame. And it's a very modest town, like I said, Southbury, North Carolina. We're all staying in the same Best Western. It's not fancy. And there was a, you know, after award show, after party, and we're all at the bar and everyone. And if you find in most sportscasters, at least I find most people in the business, they're very, you know, salt of the earth type folks. Like even, you know, the multimillionaires like Bob Costas, I saw him come in with Wendy's takeout, you know, after hours. You know, these are normal people who had to grind their way doing, you know, inter-county league baseball and on high school football, cover that for free. And so Dick Vitale and all, some of these Hall of Famers were all just sitting on a round table together in some small Holiday Inn Best Western bar. And he just came up to me. He's like, hey, can you help me with my phone? I was like, I don't know how to, it won't unlock. I don't know what to do. And I was like, Dick Vitale's asking me to open up his phone and dissect his phone. And this is insane. This is here. You're the analyst, Dick. You're supposed to give us the answers. What am I supposed to do? And so, yeah, like I just started helping him and someone took a picture of it. I'm like, this is crazy. And I held on to that. And like, I don't get starstruck much with athletes or politicians or anyone like that. But, men and women in the industry that I respect, I kind of lose it. So I thought, I was like, someone take a picture of this because this is wild. And so, yeah, that was that.
Did you get the phone fixed?
I think I needed some help. I think people, I think my wife and my brother will tell you, I am not good with technology, not even close. I'm getting better. Like, but I tried to help him. I tried my best, but I still look good.
So let's talk about the industry for a minute because you're in TV. We're both in the media here, but everyone listening is obviously a consumer of the media to some degree or another. Mm-hmm. One of the really interesting things that I've been reading about over the last few months, I guess, is CNN is under new leadership. Now, whether you like CNN, don't like CNN, there's no getting around the fact that there was a time when CNN was it. If there was an event going on, there was no Fox News, there was no MSNBC, it was CNN. You went, if the Gulf War started, you went to CNN. If there was the this or that, it was CNN. CNN has definitely, and I don't think anyone would dispute this, moved pretty far to the left. Most of their commentary is now pretty liberal. It's led to some hand-wringing and some soul-searching there because they've shed a bunch of their audience because the people who don't like that point of view don't watch them anymore. So the new guy, new leadership is there. New guy comes in and he is now saying, we're going to go back to our roots. We are going to return largely to the CNN that people remember from once upon a time when we were down the middle of the road and it didn't matter your politics, you would watch us. Do you think this can work now? Or do you think once the genie is out of the bottle, and I don't even just mean CNN, I mean everybody, once the genie is out of the bottle and everybody now has a political position, can you shove that genie back into the bottle and go back to being just straight down the middle news?
I think, yeah, I think there is an appetite for just straight facts, like actual facts that you can flesh out and explain and show with TV as the medium. Just, you know, you can show flowcharts and graphics and all that stuff. And you can bring old clips to back your points up and not just point, but not, sorry, not points, but back the facts that are happening right now. And I think there is an appetite for that, as you saw on CNN Plus. You know, I forget how $300 million they spent on it. It flopped after 10 days. They realized the appetite to pay for that narrative was just not there. And you're seeing other, if you want to call them fringe or, you know, independent news organizations that keep, like you said, keep it straight down the middle. They tell you when the Dems are doing something dumb. They tell you when the Republicans are doing something dumb and when they're doing something good. And you're seeing those subscriptions to shoot up. And so I think it's possible, and it's very possible, especially if you have the actual facts at your disposal. I think it's 100% doable. I think that's what people want. They want, because whether it happened in 2016 when, as you mentioned before, the orange guy, you know, south of the 49th was elected, it elicited this organic, seemingly organic, which eventually turned into a money-filled response, you know, from the likes of CNN and the other guys with Fox. And, you know, it has divided a lot of people. And if they can somehow, you know, reel it back, I don't know how they're going to do it, because a lot of their on-air stars, you learned who they were when they just started talking off the cuff. You're supposed to be an anchor. Like, you're not supposed to give your opinion. It's not about your opinion. You're the talking person. You bring in the experts. It's not about you. It's about them. And if they can get the egos that they have there on both sides, if Fox will ever subscribe to that, to be like, look, it's not about you. Remember, it's about the experts. It's about the people we're covering. It's not about, we don't care what you think. I think it's possible if their talent have the, you know, the what's the word, if they're able to just maneuver. And like a lot of us have to do, you know, when things change in our workplace, if they can do that, then I think it's possible, and they can regain that trust. Cause yeah, like you said, there's a good bunch of people that, you know, they just feel like, I can't watch this because it's just so in your face. And the same thing with the other side.
There was a, I'll always remember it was probably two presidential elections ago. And I was flipping around and CNN had a panel after one of the presidential debates. I'm sure it was a Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump debate. And they had a panel of, it was either seven or nine. I think it was nine panelists. It was ridiculous. First of all, that you have that many people. This is, you know, too many voices, but seven of them were liberal Democratic operatives and two were rather feeble Republicans. And I thought, you're not even trying at this point to look like you're being down the middle. The idea that you're going to go back to this, I think it's from either side, and we're using CNN because they are the ones who are saying they're doing this, but it can be from anybody. I think it's an admirable thing. I just wonder, Phil, that after you've been fed a diet of nothing but processed sugar for as long as you have, are you going to be satisfied if they start just feeding you tofu?
Right. Right. I think, I guess it would depend on, well, I guess something really bad did happen, like in Texas, that could have been, unfortunately, an opportunity to show that. I don't know how long it's going to take for them to bring in the producers and all these people to try to mold, you know, the brand that they want. But I guess time will tell when something happens, whether it's the next U.S. presidential election. How are they going to play that? Are they going to play that down the middle, or are they going to do, like you said, but, you know, seven Dems, two Republicans on the panel? It's going to come up to something like that to show the people that, look, we've changed. We've done it organically. We're not shoving it. If they come up with if they come up with an ad that says, we got the truth for you, like all we have is facts, like I think that's going to turn people off, just because at this point, you know, what, for the last couple of years, like what you did tell us that was the truth. You told us this was the way, and that's just your way. So if they just show it in however programming and whatever event that it is, whether it's the next presidential election or unfortunately, you know, some a tragedy or something, if they can just play it with the facts, and I think that's, and then people could just go there to get the facts, straight facts, then I think they could maybe win it over. It might take a couple generations.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. I don't think you can do this overnight. I don't think you can flip a switch and have people forget, especially if you're an anchor or a personality who has been very opinionated, to suddenly
and rewarded for it.
and rewarded for it, for sure. They make a lot of dough, some of the people on those stations. But to be very opinionated and then all of a sudden to not be, but have people forget that you had those opinions before, I don't think they forget that easily.
No, especially the very upfront ones. And I'll be honest, like I don't watch it a lot because I have like internet TV. And so it's with a cable provider. So I'm not like shooting my own house. That's what pays our bills. But I don't know where the channel is. So I just don't find it. And when I get home, I literally only have like 2 hours and I get to watch like, you know, one episode of Obi-Wan Kenobi and then maybe a little bit of sports at the same time. I don't have time to like scan and see where everyone is. But I remember when I was in 2001 when the Twin Towers happened, like I went to CNN, boom, that's where I went to. And that at that moment, I'm like, well, they're right there. And I remember they were right there and they were telling me everything I needed to know. There was no sway. They weren't blaming anybody at this point. And they were just giving me the facts. I'm like, whoa, CNN is the truth. Like it's, and then that's kind of what I just went to. I went to that. And then as time went on, I got older and I got into the biz. I was like, whoa, these guys are yelling at me. Why are you yelling at me? And it's so strange. And I thought that was, yeah. Maybe if they change now, maybe there's some, you know, grade 10 student watching, you know, the next election and they're just like, oh, these guys aren't yelling at me. They're just telling me how it is. They're not saying why the other candidate sucks and why the other candidate's so much better for like in terms of their own personal feelings, then, you know, I could follow this. And so, I think it might take a generation.
You said something a few moments ago, though, that I really, I think is really bang on. And there's a lot of things you said that were bang on, but that really stood out. And that is that for years, they've been telling you what we're telling you is the truth. So to now adjust and say, okay, now it's the new truth. This is the big problem, I think. And it's not just media. It's not just TV. It's society almost. And I don't want to get, you know, overly deep, but you know, the Oprahfication of truth. It's your truth. Mm. Well, there's no such thing as your truth. It's either true or it's not true. It's your truth is your opinion.
Right.
And when we've made this so that truth is a malleable thing where it's, well, depending on which side you're coming from, that's the truth. No, it's either true or it's not true. And I don't know how we get back to that when we've conditioned people now to say, you're entitled to your own truth. That seems to me to be a huge obstacle to get over.
Yeah, I think, and it comes with, like, do people even have the attention span for someone to explain why it is the truth instead of just saying like, it's either I feel this way or that's just fake news. Like, you know, if you have time, it's so easy to say those things now. But if someone has because people watch documentaries all the time, like those things are an hour and a half, 2 hours, and you're seemingly getting truth, you would assume. But if people have the time for the anchor or for the reporter to flesh out, like, this is what happened. Like I think, what's his name? Last week with John Oliver or this week tonight with John Oliver, they do a good job of really just honing down one topic for multiple minutes at a time, like entire segments normally in a regular newscast, and just fleshing out something that is well researched, and they make it entertaining. It doesn't have to be entertaining, but informative. Then I think that's how you try to win it over. Like, look, we have documents from all this. We have clips from all this. We're not going to cut the clips funny because that's where they always catch you. You know, well, we cut this clip. Like, yeah, but you forgot the context and all this stuff. But, you know, we had a segment on CH called More on That. We had full on 7-minute interviews that we just showed on a only 1-hour show, you know, and if people have the patience to watch that kind of stuff and then be proven that this is the truth, then I think that could be reached. Maybe I'm being very idealistic here.
Well, but I don't know, because I mean, even like a show, go back a few years on Netflix, the show, the documentary series that everybody watched, Making a Murderer. Yeah. Everybody was watching this and talking about it, and everybody came to the exact same conclusion, it seems. And that told me two things. Either that's because all the evidence pointed in that way, and so you came to that conclusion because, well, obviously that's what all the evidence was, or the documentary filmmakers were very skilled and directed you in a way, but they left out a few things that, right, you know, there had to be a reason he was convicted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like the jury had to have seen something that we didn't see, or else they wouldn't have convicted him. And so truth, and look, I'm not getting into Making a Murderer. You can go watch it and decide for yourself, but it's so difficult. And I don't know how a company like CNN or whatever goes back. I hope they can. I really do. I really hope they can go back and become what they were, because you're right. When the Twin Towers fell, or again, the Gulf War or whatever, I remember watching the Gulf War, the green dots on the screen, not having a clue what I was watching, but Bernard King and or Bernard Shaw, Bernard King, whatever his name was, hiding under his bed in the probably, you weren't even born yet, probably. but anyway, I hope they could get back to that. We need something like that. We need that to be there to help us figure out what's going on in the world, because right now it's just all yelling.
Yeah, I hate it. I'm not a fan of it. I don't like being yelled at. And I think the context is also king. I feel like we're such like a, you know, a quick 15-second Instagram story clip. That's all we get is that little clip. And, you know, I talk about all the time at CH. I'm like, gosh, we always say, like talking with our mutual friend Bubba, we have a conversation, like 30 seconds, we can have a conversation. I always say, save it for the podcast. And I talk to all these people, and I tell them all the time, like, you know, we have a 20-minute Zoom conversation, like, man, this is gonna be a 90-second report. And I know I'm gonna get killed for this, because I'm missing something. If someone's gonna point it out, I wish we could just flesh it out and have the whole thing out there. And we've done that on YouTube and try to get some of our, especially during the pandemic, you know, talk to infectious disease experts and put it all out there in a 30-minute segment. And my only fear is why it might not be possible for like a CNN to put the genie back is I don't know if anyone's attention span is there, because, you know, no one's going to watch a 1-hour, 2-hour long explainer on gun reform and whose fault Uvalde was for 2 hours. No one's going to watch that on Instagram. They're like, boring. Like, just tell me who I should hate right now. And you know,
Exactly. Like, whittle it down, yeah. Whittle it down and make it simple for me.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
We've talked a couple times about your love of sports, your background in sports. I believe you were actually a football player too, weren't you, in university?
Sure was. One year.
What position?
I was running back. I was a running back. I think I was the only recruit for running back, but I played with some legit CFLers when York University made it to the playoffs. I don't know if they've been back, but
I don't know if they've won a game since.
leading up to that. It was bad. Now we beat UFT. I remember we did that. I think we may have beat Waterloo, but I played with like Andre Dury, who played with the Argo.
Yeah.
Ricky Foley.
Yeah.
Won a great cup with the Argos. I think it was Saskatchewan. So I played with some, and I think he had some time with the Baltimore Ravens as well. So I played with some like legit guys, but then I probably should have stayed another year of high school. My brain was just not there. I didn't understand what commitment was. I had no idea. Did not know about sacrifice. I remember not showing up to go work out during Easter. And I was like, what? Why would I go work out? It's Easter. And it was, I was not a good athlete in that sense. I shaped up later on in life. That's for sure, though.
So knowing football then, let me throw this one at you. This story about Deshaun Watson is for those who don't know, Deshaun Watson was a quarterback with the Houston Texans. He got himself seemingly in endless amounts of trouble. He's now facing 24 civil lawsuits from women who worked as massage therapists for the, well, the accusations are, we're not going to talk about them in detail on the show. Just let your imagination run wild. You could probably guess. Sports Illustrated has reported that he sought massages from 60 or 66 different people. It's just, it's a complete mess. He was traded to the, or he signed with the Cleveland Browns for two. They gave him a $230 million guaranteed contract, despite knowing about all this stuff, which just, it baffles me. It boggles me that they would do this. What do you do with Deshaun? If you're the NFL, what do you do with Deshaun Watson? He's not been found guilty of anything, and right, there's no criminal charges pending.
Right.
But what do you do with him?
Man. And what did they do? Oh, gosh. It just makes you think about what is the right thing for them to do? What are they going to do? Are they just going to follow the letter of the laws? Like, well, he's not guilty, right? But then you have, I forget how the commissioner's exempt list works, where the commissioner kind of makes his own call. And if that's the case, I don't think he plays this season until things, because it is an awful look for the NFL to trot this guy out week one against the Carolina Panthers, another team that actually didn't do as much of their homework as the New York Times journalist did. To look deeper into who this guy was allegedly, and you know, still trot out breast cancer awareness merch to try to make money, and you know, talk about all the great things you're doing for women in the game, coaching, officiating, playing. You just can't put him out there. I don't think the Cleveland Browns can do anything personally. But I think the NFL could do something. And if Roger Goodell has learned anything from the blowback from how they dealt with Ray Rice, Adrian Peterson, Ben Roethlisberger, who I think people kind of have swept under the rug and kind of don't talk about as much. The things that he allegedly did, I think there's a bit more evidence that like physical evidence on what he did in his earlier years in the NFL. And I think he just got four games. Suspended for four games, where Tom Brady got four games for deflating footballs.
Maybe.
Yeah, potentially. Maybe he's got really strong grip. I don't know. He went to Michigan. It's a tough life. Tough life in Ann Arbor. But you can't trot him out there. I don't think you can. And I don't think this guy, he's got the optics this guy has or doesn't have is just so wild. I don't think you can trot him out. You could put him on the commissioner exempt list for a year and hopefully these legal proceedings pass on and you come up with a legal answer on what happened and then act on that. But it's just such an awful look for the NFL that doesn't exactly do great with this kind of stuff when it comes to disciplinary actions against athletes in situations, unfortunately, that involve, you know, this type of stuff, and you can't put them out there.
I don't know what you do. Like, yeah. I want to be consistent because on this show, we've talked before over the years about guys who have been facing a charge or an allegation.
Right.
And it's always, to me, it's always tricky because you want to believe the women, but you are also entitled to be innocent until proven guilty. So I'm always somewhat nervous when a league says you can't play because there's an allegation against you and right, that you, and if it turns out that it's not accurate or not real or whatever else, you've destroyed this person. So, but on the other hand, if you did it, well, you shouldn't be playing and making your millions of dollars. So it's very difficult that way. This time there are 24 women.
No turning away from that. Yeah.
And not only that, but I believe, and I stand to be corrected on this, I believe that many of these women don't know each other. And so their allegations were sort of individually collected and they, you know, like if there's overlap, it's not because there were, you can't argue that they were somehow conspiring together to make their story sound alike. So I just don't know. I'm with you. It seems like there's no possible way that a league that wants to have a female fan base, which the NFL does, could possibly put a guy out there who's got these kind of allegations against him. I don't know how you could possibly do that.
No, and you have women owners now, like the Buffalo Bills. You know, they're partially owned by a woman, like the Pegulas. His wife is a part owner as well. And you have the New Orleans Saints owned by a woman. And so you would assume that they'd step up and be like, this is ridiculous. And, you know, it's one thing, like I said, I'm not saying it's still a life, and it's a life that's tormented by all these women. But whatever happened with Ben Roethlisberger is one person, he got that. This is the guy who's, I don't even think he even went to court for this, but Deshaun Watson got, like you said, 24 who are saying the same thing. And from what I understand, I don't think any team actually reached out to the women when they were doing their background checks on Deshaun Watson. And this sports reporter for the New York Times clearly did, because Deshaun Watson has been a Cleveland Brown for months now. And this report just came out this week. So they've obviously done their due diligence. And you said they individually reached out to. And yeah, I just, PR wise, and I'll be honest, like, I'm a Carolina Panthers fan. We can save that for a whole other show. Huh. I was talking with other fans. I'm like, man, if he does choose Carolina, because he went to Clemson in South Carolina, like closer to his home in Georgia. And he's like, man, if he does join this team, are you ready for the hate that's going to come your way? And then, and it happened with the Browns, and they gave him everything. And even the way they formulated his contract this year, I think he's making $1 million. That's it. Assuming that he does get suspended, he won't lose any of the game checks that $250 million contract would have given him.
Right. Because just to explain, So if you're suspended, you lose your pay based on the number of games and your pay. So he gets almost nothing, relatively speaking, this year, assuming his agents are assuming he'll get suspended this year. So he loses basically nothing.
Right.
And then comes back next year, and all of a sudden the big money kicks in. I cannot for the life of me, here's the biggest thing to me, I cannot for the life of me contemplate the absolute, I don't even know, I guess I'm allowed to say this, brain fartitude of the Cleveland Browns, that you would make this move. It's, if you had done this and you had discovered afterwards that this stuff had been secretly brewing or percolating in the background, that's one thing. You did this knowing this stuff was going on, knowing this could blow up, and knowing that even if it doesn't blow up, your female fans, presumably, and a lot of guy fans, are going to say, wait a second, this, how am I supposed to cheer for this guy? And yet they signed him for $230 million over 5 years. It's insanity.
Yeah. And I don't know what's like that and what we just mentioned, like they finagled the finances knowing that they're going to maybe not even have him this year, because he's going to get suspended. He also might go to jail. and they formulated so that he'd still get paid. He'd still get all that money. Still, he gets suspended this year, no skin off his back. And it is gross, but it's not just the Browns. Every team, like I said, the Panthers, I think the Niners were somewhat in the mix. The Atlanta Falcons, the New Orleans Saints, you know, they were all in. They were all in. And, you know, they all want it because it's talent, right? Winning solves everything. That's sports. And we were talking about that earlier at the top of the show, talking about Liv and talking about, you know, Newcastle. Who owns these teams? Like people who do some bad stuff. And you know, it's, people put that aside to make the cash, but I don't know if the NFL could, not they wouldn't survive. They've survived a lot of stuff. But you know, they survived Michael Vick killing dogs. Michael Vick survived Michael Vick killing dogs. And, you know, I just, in a PR standpoint, you can't trot them out there. And how many primetime games do the Cleveland Browns have this year? Like a lot, don't they?
At this point, I'd be surprised if they don't play them Tuesday mornings at 9 a.m. to make sure that nobody's watching.
Yeah.
You know, they don't, now the NFL has got this team that is one of the great franchises. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily winning, but one of the great historic franchises, and you can't even show them because you don't want your play-by-play people having to talk about this on the air. You're gonna hide them.
Well, not only that, you have your play-by-play. Your there are female play-by-play anchors. There's female sideline reporters, female hosts in the studio show. Like, they're going to have to do this every Sunday. Talk about this every Sunday.
Every Sunday. Everyone.
And then they're going to get berated on social media. I've already seen Mina Kimes, who I think is one of the smartest football minds out there, getting destroyed by talking about Deshaun. Well, not ripping Deshaun, just talking about it. And I can't imagine, because there are those hardcore sports people who don't see the human side of anything. You know, they just go, you know, they bleed Cleveland Brown forever, and they're going to
matter,
you
know, long as we win.
It doesn't matter.
We win.
Yeah. But yeah, it's rough.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Phil, let me read you something, which I just, it cracked me up because it's just, well, I'll read it and then we'll tell you. This is Madonna. I don't even know where to start with this. This is Madonna speaking. Madonna is apparently going to make a biopic about Madonna, directed by Madonna, because, well, it's, in her words, it's essential to share the roller coaster ride of my life with my voice and vision. Phil, it is essential that you, Phil Perkins, and me, Scott Radley, and all the people listening watch a movie about Madonna positioned in a way that will be glamorizing her, because it's that crucial that we as a society know what happened with Madonna and are up to date on all the nuances of her life.
I just want to know when she got the British accent and then how it started, how it ended. I just want that. I want the truth. We were talking about the truth in news. This is the opposite of that. We will not get that. We will not get the truth in any of this. But that's the most Madonna thing I've ever heard. I feel like if Prince was alive right now, you know, RIP, I feel like he would do the exact same thing. And if Michael Jackson was still alive, he would do the exact. I'm sure he did do that. But if he had a bio, I feel like all three of those icons would do the exact same thing. And they do or they just cast themselves, I guess. You can de-age now, right? And so
that's right. After the what was that movie? The Irish the Irishman.
Ooh, it's gotten a lot better since that. That's for sure.
No, I you're probably right. Ever since Bohemian Rhapsody, I think the music biopic has become the thing that everybody has to do, because we had Rocket Man after that with Elton John, and now Madonna. But the difference was Bohemian Rhapsody. There were parts of it that were not really all that complimentary of Freddie Mercury. There were parts that were warts. I'm not positive we're going to get a whole lot of the Madonna warts. And that's probably a horrible turn of phrase, but.
Yeah. Oh, ouch. Yeah. I hope she does. That'd be cool. Maybe she hooks up, you know, intellectually with her former partner, Guy Ritchie. Maybe he can give some pointers like, hey, you know, people might just watch us anyways because it's Madonna. But maybe he can give some pointers like, but then you could like maybe win some awards if you do this properly and, you know, show the awards. Because that's what made, you know, biopics like Ray so great. And like Bohemian Rhapsody. You saw those warts. And so people want to see that stuff.
Yeah, maybe Jose Canseco going to have a cameo in this one as well. And I don't know who else. I've lost track of who the other ones are.
Ice Cube? No, not Ice Cube. Vanilla Ice. Was it Vanilla Ice?
I think, yes. I think now that you say it, yeah, there probably was that too. Yeah. But so we've had, you mentioned Ray. I forgot about Ray, which was actually a really good biopic. And we've had Freddie Mercury and we've had Elton John. Who would you want? Who would be the musician, assuming now that everybody's going to go through this treatment? Who do you want to see a biopic of?
Well, it sounds like a cop-out, but I'm surprised that it took until 2022 to get an Elvis biopic.
Yes.
The fact that I'm hyped for that. I am too. I know Elvis, I'm aware of him, but there was a stage where there was a ton of Elvis documentaries. We've been talking about documentaries on Netflix about him, and this guy's voice was crazy. I just thought he did, like, I've heard his voice, you know, like I went to a school where guitar was part of the curriculum, grade 7 and 8, and I played like Blue Suede Shoes and all that stuff, but his voice was so wild and so crazy. And his story is amazing. And I may have got my facts wrong, but he's like part indigenous as well. I didn't know that. And I just think he's just a great story. And they will definitely tell the warts in that movie. And it's just amazing. I'm very intrigued to see what they do with that. And he's one guy. maybe even like I mentioned before, like a Michael Jackson biopic, tons of words. You might have to do, that'd be a trilogy right there.
Yeah, the childhood, the superstardom, and then the weird phase. I mean, there was there were actually a lot of weird phases in the weird phases, but yes, it's the Macaulay Culkin era, or shall we call it? But
yeah, the monkey era. They had a chimpanzee situation.
Yeah, whatever. Bubbles the chimp. Yeah, Bubbles the chimp.
Yeah, there you go. Or maybe some modern ones like Jay-Z. Is Jay-Z almost 60? Like a Jay-Z biopic? But I think that'd be kind of good. I think these people deserve biopics. Who doesn't deserve biopics? And I think I mentioned this on the show. There's a Lizzo documentary coming out. Why is Lizzo getting a documentary? She's been around for like 5 minutes. I don't understand. So yeah, someone like Lizzo, if you got popular like 2018 to now, you shouldn't get a biopic. But someone like Jay-Z, I think he deserves one. And yeah, Elvis, excited about that. And then yeah, Michael Jackson. Yeah, I'd go for that trio.
Yeah, you know what? That's pretty. I mean, there is a ton. I mean, you could be, especially when you think of what happened in rock during the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and the stories behind the scenes. I mean, what was the one that was just out? I only saw about 5 minutes of it. The one about Motley Crue.
Wasn't that the Pam tapes? Are we talking about?
No, it's on Netflix, and it's on Netflix, and it's about Motley Crue. And it's not called like a documentary of Motley Crue. It's called something else. And I didn't see a whole lot of it, but you got to believe that there's stuff that was happening behind the scenes that would make for interesting stories. I just, any artist that, and look, I'm not taking away from Madonna's success. She sold like 300 million records or something. Like, she's been highly successful, but anyone who tells me that it's essential that I know the story of her life, like she is somehow, you know, this integral part of world history that children at school should not be able to graduate without being able to recite the dates and facts of her being. I think I'll take a hard pass on that one, honestly.
Are the Razzies still around? I feel like that could be a Razzie.
Could be in contention. Yeah. Listen, we got to run. I wish we could do this more, but Phil Perkins, really appreciate you taking a few minutes today. Well, more than a few minutes, taking a couple hours today to join us. This was fun. Thanks for doing this.
So much fun, Scott. It was a good time. And shout out to CH with the high def Pilsner, powered me through. And yeah, I've only had one, so it was good.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.